This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. As the race for president continues, the candidates will address how they will handle global affairs. An ongoing conversation in the U.S. and abroad involves LGBT rights. In North Carolina, HB2 remains controversial. Those who oppose the law say it limits transgender rights. Arguments over laws like HB2 show that the U.S. remains divided over some LGBT issues. So when American leaders are on the international stage, to what degree should they press other countries on LGBT rights? This week, WUNC is participating in a national week of conversation along with other NPR stations. The project is called A Nation Engaged, and we are asking the question, how do LGBT rights in the U.S. compare with other countries? Joining me now is Lawrence Helfer. He's a law professor at Duke University. Welcome, Lawrence. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
Also with us is Leila Cordova. She's a transgender activist and facilitator from the Durham Gender Alliance. Welcome, Leila.
Thank you.
Nice to have you here. You're originally from Chile, and I wonder if you can tell us what the culture surrounding LGBT rights and comfort is in Chile.
Right now, it's quite diverse. There are several organizations of national reach, which are basically struggling for LGBT rights. Mm.
What was the culture like growing up for you?
Oh, there was nothing. Mm. There was nothing. And I didn't get to a therapist until I was 17 in high school. And the therapist who just came from the United States and all that told me, well, you know, it's okay that you're transgender, but you have to keep it under wraps because there's no support outside.
Hmm. So that makes it hard to understand what it would mean to be okay if you have to keep it under wraps, right?
Right.
Pretty serious conflict. Well, you left Chile following the coup in the early 70s. Tell us about that time. Is that why you left?
Exactly, yes. Yeah. About 3 months after the coup, the Faculty of Sciences, where I was a student and a lecturer, convoke a clandestine meeting because the meeting was not allowed. And essentially the faculty told us, I mean, then 3 months after the coup, already about 50% of the faculty were gone, either picked up by the police, put in concentration camps, or just had found refuge in embassies. And they were in several degrees of exit in the country. So the faculty told us, you need to leave because we cannot complete your education here. And we will do all this within our reach to help you. And that's how I and my partner at the time began writing letters. And by January of 1974, we got some good news. So my partner had been trained in the United States in MIT. And so she knew someone who was now a chairman at Duke. And that allowed us to find positions here.
Now, that was 1974 in Durham, North Carolina.
Yes.
What was the reception here when you came out?
It was only openly welcoming from a couple of Chilean people that we knew who were here also. And otherwise, there was no public support. Not in Durham, in other places, in bigger cities, of course. There were committees to support what was happening in Chile. I mean, the victims and denunciations about what was going on.
So did you feel like you felt in Chile the same thing? You had to keep things under wraps while you were here?
Oh, yeah. Initially, at least.
Lawrence Helfer, you have worked with the U.S. State Department and a U.N. panel on LGBT rights. let's look at the U.S. first. What approach, you know, should the U.S. government be taking abroad in promoting LGBT rights, do you think?
So the U.S. has changed its policies quite significantly over the last several years. It began in late 2011 when President Obama issued a memorandum essentially making the promotion of LGBT rights part of the United States' ongoing human rights advocacy and outreach. And on the same day, Secretary Clinton gave a very well publicized speech in the United Nations essentially saying gay rights are human rights, the two are the same, we're going to promote them abroad. And since then, the United States has continued along the same lines. They've established a global equality fund to assist local organizations in countries in the global south to document ongoing violations, to engage in advocacy for legal and social change. They've partnered with civil society groups. The U.S. government has other governments within the United Nations, and most recently leading up to the appointment last year of a special envoy for the human rights of LGBTI persons. And that has, I would say, produced quite a bit of engagement. And the question that is often asked is this a positive force for change around the world? And I think the answer to that is that the types of engagement really matter. And I would say that overall, the U.S. government has been very smart about this in that they have kept the focus, sort of a dual focus, if you will. On the one hand, empowering local LGBT groups to determine the scope and pace of change, and at the same time, shoring up support in multilateral venues like the United Nations or regional organizations where they have made the case that LGBT rights are human rights, that they're not special rights. And they have worked with a growing coalition of allied governments in Europe, but increasingly in Latin America and Asia to push that agenda forward. So it's a kind of two-part strategy, if you will. And I think thus far it has looks to be very promising.
So you've got this, again, the two-part strategy. Let's make a case for this at the international level. And then if we get on the ground, work with local organizations and sort of avoid the so-called Marriott professors traipsing over from the U.S. lecturing on these
subjects. Oh, that's exactly right. I think the one thing that would be counterproductive would be to use the kind of, if you think about the metaphor of carrots and sticks, big sticks like sanctions, economic sanctions or travel bans. I think it's been much more about engagement and about having the diplomatic corps as well as U.S. government representatives and other civil society groups that are sympathetic to themselves be more visible. To be supported financially in other ways so that they can determine what the next steps for change ought to be.
Well, Leah, let's talk again a little bit more about your situation because you talked about you're coming from Chile where you had to keep things under wraps, you get to Durham and you still can't really come out, and you didn't until the mid-1990s, right?
Exactly.
Tell us about coming out then in the 90s and what had changed.
There wasn't an obvious change then to me, but I was able to connect with a group of lesbian women at Duke who direct me to the Women's Center at Duke, which was already active. And so I approached the Women's Center in 1995, when I had recently separated and divorced. I was in the process of divorcing my wife. And I found a welcoming ear there. So that was the year also that I began hormones, and I saw an endocrinologist and all that. And I was ecstatic when the Women's Center announced in October maybe of 95 that they were having a tea dance. And I could come with my girlfriend at the time. So that was incredible. I couldn't believe that I was out at Duke in a public function dancing with my girlfriend in this lovely, welcoming semi-open space. That one of the highlights of that period.
And has it? Have you found it then more comfortable now, certainly than then? Is it, or are there times when you feel that you can't be as open?
Well, I've been a patient at Duke since I came to Duke in 1974, so I've been a patient 43 years there. And I've experienced a lot of difficulties. Originally, I would come to the reception in a clinic, and I had one receptionist leave. Just leave. Let me there waiting. Mm. Others had to go consult with a supervisor. It came to such that I once ended up crying at the clinic room with my doctor, and he very determinedly called IT and asked them to change my sex on my medical record. And since then, I had no trouble. But that was quite dramatic. Yeah. And from then on, I didn't have much trouble. I got some weird looks and all, but I was legit according to the documentation.
Well, Larry, this is not a settled issue in the United States, as the debate over HB2 shows us. I'm going to play a clip of this is a clip of Governor Pat McCrory speaking last month at a candidates forum in Pinehurst about HB2 and the rationale for it in his mind. Let's listen.
I disagree with the Attorney General, and I disagree with the President of the United States, who not only want to put this requirement on all private sector entities, when I think that's your decision. They are now telling our schools, I'm talking about our elementary, junior high, and high schools, to recognize a concept of gender identity to allow a boy into a girl's shower, locker room, or bathroom facility based upon what they think they are, not what they are.
All right, so that's Governor Pat McCrory, governor of North Carolina, at a candidates forum in Pinehurst last month. I'm talking with Duke Law Professor Lawrence Helfer and local transgender activist Leah Cordova. Lawrence, you know, if you go abroad and we're talking about transgender rights, and then you hear the governor of a state like North Carolina misunderstand human biology in the way that he just did by thinking that genitalia defines forever, when biologists and physicians will tell you there's much more to it than that. He doesn't seem to know. When you're in Kampala, if you were in Kampala and they said to you, well, look at what they say in North Carolina, why should you make me believe this? What do you say?
So I think there are two sets of responses. First of all, I think you've actually made one of them, which is that the governor's statement is based on a misunderstanding. I think it's also fair to say that one of the best ways to convince individuals who are themselves wrestling with issues that may be unfamiliar or new is to say that we in the United States have been quite open and honest about how difficult change can be, and that we have these open conversations in which those individuals who are affected by a discriminatory law can explain the ways in which the discrimination unfolds, that in fact we aren't talking about an individual who simply decides and one day to change his or her gender, but rather we're talking about individuals who have been through the kinds of struggles that Leah has described, that it's a very serious decision to be made. And once that's understood, I think that the fact that we are going through our own evolution on these issues, and rapid as it has been within the United States, it's still very much an area of change. And I think that the fact that we can be open about that and also recognize that change will occur in different ways in different countries can be part of having that conversation. I think we can't be closed about the fact that we have differences between, in this instance, the federal government of the United States and the current North Carolina government. But that is part of the conversation by which advocacy unfolds.
What about the other complaint? And here's another criticism from a completely other direction, which is this is another form of neocolonialism. Here is the United States preaching to the world what its values should be.
So I think it's important to remember a couple of different things in regard to that. So first of all, although this relates to a country other than the United States, many of the laws that prohibit intimate same-sex sexual conduct are products of colonialism, British laws or Portuguese laws that were imposed on countries in Asia or Africa by colonial powers. So I think it's important to keep the broader history in mind. I think secondly, the other point to keep in mind is that governments that are repressive will often raise the trope of neocolonialism or Western decadence as a wedge issue to bolster their own rule. And so this is, again, to come back to why empowering local groups is so important. If the United States is seen as imposing its particular views of its own laws onto other countries, that will precipitate a reaction. On the other hand, if it is drawing upon universally applicable international human rights standards, and if it is at the same time empowering local groups to be the agents for change, to advocate with government officials, to bring litigation in court, to train police officers, as the case may be, to be able to register as LGBT rights advocacy organizations. There have been real successes in that in, for example, Botswana and in Kenya, where groups have started to now have official legal status, and as a result of that, can actually foment change on their own with assistance transnationally.
Leah, I wonder how you feel about that as someone who grew up in Chile, where that argument might have some traction, the neocolonial argument might have traction, but as someone who has also suffered because of discrimination, how you feel about that argument?
Well, there are two places I need to address. One is the fact that the United States is a relative latecomer to the conversation, since it was only in 2011 that of that speech by Secretary Clinton at the time. Although I have to recognize that the Obama administration has done great steps ahead in this regard, but I also have to remind my co-presenter that I considered the policies of the United States late because the Scandinavian country has been helping Chile in particular with the issue of that they disappear and also with sexual minorities since the reinstatement of the civil government in Chile in 1989. So I don't find that the United States should be so forceful in imposing criteria for this kind of thing, because they are behind decades with respect to what happened in the Scandinavian countries, and in particular in Holland, which has the distinction of being keeping the longest records of follow-up for transgender people. And so I object to the arrogance of the United States in trying to appear grand stance with respect to these things, since in 2011 here we had a lot of LGBT issues. We still do.
Well, I want to thank you both for being on the program. We are out of time, but I want to thank you, Leah Cordova, and also Lawrence Helfer. Lawrence Helfer, a law professor at Duke University. Leah is a transgender activist and facilitator for the Durham Gender Alliance. Thank you both for being on the program.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Just ahead, we're going to talk about how A Chef's Life moves into its fourth year. We'll talk about that and the new season and a new cookbook, all that on The State of Things. Stay tuned.